You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
LSAT, MCAT, ACT, SAT, GPA, IQ, there are most common measures of intelligence. The higher the score, the smarter you are, and the more likely you'll be a success in life. But according to Scott Barry Kaufman, professor of psychology at New York University, it's not that simple. He found himself on the wrong end of such assessments during his time in school, and in his latest book, which is part memoir, part criticism, he argues that the way schools measure intelligence is misguided and narrow in scope and actually holds children back from achieving greatness instead of helping them towards it. Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined is published by Basic Books, and I'm very pleased that has brought Scott Barry Kaufman to our show. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You set out in part to answer a question that's been on the minds of scientists and philosophers for a very long time. What is intelligence and where does it come from? Well, given that from what you've studied, what would you say intelligence is?
What is intelligence, right?
So, can you define it?
I can tell you what we've been leaving out of our current conceptualizations of intelligence. And I'm not for coming up with necessarily a precise definition that will limit people, but try to change the framing of what intelligence really means. So traditionally, we have this very common conception. If I say, what does it mean to you to be smart? In our culture, most people would think like Big Bang Theory sort of thing, Sheldon. You know, they think, oh, Sheldon's really smart, or people in Jeopardy are really smart. People who do really good in school are really smart. And I think that what we leave out of that by measuring everyone's smartness to one standardized kind of mind, so to the extent to which you deviate from the kind of mind which is Sheldon or Jeopardy or people who are very academically inclined, I don't think that should be the extent to which you deviate from, quote, intelligence or smartness. So what I think we need to put back into our conceptualization of intelligence is the person, the whole person, and the individual. And we'll see intelligence in lots of ways.
So there are multiple intelligences.
Right, right.
Somebody might be really strong in one area but not another, but we tend to give most weight to the one who remembers all the facts.
This is the problem I have with multiple intelligence theories. I think it's still operating within a paradigm that we've been operating in for the past 100 years. So it started off with IQ, where we compared people to each other on a single global score. And as far as I'm concerned, theories of multiple intelligences just add on more abilities, but we're still comparing people to each other on these abilities, and we're still limiting the abilities that people can show. So what I want to shift is the level of analysis. I think it's really time to shift this analysis from looking at comparing individual differences to comparing within an individual's development their past and their future self.
How do children's IQ scores or scores on similar aptitude tests factor into the quality of education they go on to receive?
So I'm not anti-IQ. I want to say that on the outset. I think that these tests can be valuable in proper placement and proper understanding people's patterns of strengths and weaknesses. So even if we – let's, you know, back up a second and say, you know what, let's just accept that IQ is a good measure. The IQ test measures intelligence really well. Even if we just accept that, there are lots of improvements we can do to really understand the person. So it turns out that IQ tests don't measure a single ability. There's no such thing as intelligence as a singular thing, even on IQ tests.
But aren't IQ tests also, can't they, the same person's IQ vary a lot over the years or from test to test? And I'm assuming that if you come from a certain background, even though the genes might be perfectly fine, you will score lower on an IQ test than somebody who comes from a more privileged background.
That's absolutely
correct.
Or a
richer background.
That's absolutely correct. And in researching this book, I didn't only look at scientific research, but I also wanted to look at programs that deal with disadvantaged children. And I wanted to see, you know, firsthand what happens if we give more people a chance from disadvantaged backgrounds. Yeah.
Well, is intelligence really a matter of what we know or what our potential is?
So the word potential is something I want to reconceptualize as well, if you'll allow me to. So I see potential as not something that you're born with that determines your ultimate potential for achieving something in life. I see potential as a moving target, and I see it a moving target as a function of engagement. So this is what I think has been seriously lacking in our discussions of potential and achievement and intelligence is this engagement factor. It turns out the more you engage in something, you are literally changing the odds of your potential of achieving in that thing. So that means if we reduce opportunities for people to engage in something they're passionate about through testing like SATs, IQ, we're making the decision we're limiting their potential.
Well, we don't do it as much as some other countries have. Totalitarian states would test a kid and say, okay, you're going to become a piano player, or you're not going to be able to play piano even though you love it because you are good with numbers. And so kids were forced into professions and then they had to keep their other passions secret.
That is exactly what I'm railing against. Yes,
but that doesn't happen in our society, does it?
No, it doesn't. But in this society, what we do is we take these labels, which can serve useful purposes, but then what we do is we assume potential based on these labels, and we assume that these labels are measuring something fixed.
How much is intelligence genetic?
So there is a genetic contribution to every psychological trait that's ever been studied, from your extroversion to how neurotic you are to even, you know, grit is talked about a lot. That has a genetic component too. So everything has a genetic component. What that means, it doesn't mean it's destiny. It means that there is an influence of genes, yes.
Well, we start testing kids how early?
In New York City at 4.
A brain isn't fully formed at 4.
Absolutely not. In fact, all the way up to adolescence, the brain and maturation is in flux.
Can IQ be taught?
I do. Absolutely. I think it absolutely can be taught. And there's a lot of research suggesting even things like more years of schooling, less summer breaks, lots of environmental factors fiddle with the dials of IQ.
So we start testing kids at 4. And then we test them throughout their lives. It varies from state to state, but in the end, do these standardized tests and IQ tests have any hold any real weight in assessing a student's aptitude?
It depends on what you're trying to predict. And this is something that I think we should frame the debate more in terms of understanding what is the child actually, what is their goal. So if the child's goal is to be a physicist, biologist, these IQ tests do measure certain kinds of abstract thinking skills. They're going to be very important for that. But for a wide swath of other things like art, music, architecture, design. I mean, there's so many other things that people can
achieve. Who like to work with their hands.
So many things. I could go on this list for the next 4 hours, yeah.
So somebody might be really great at putting things together, but not so good at learning a foreign language.
That's absolutely.
And then in the end, that kid doesn't do well in school.
Yeah, and then if we take them away from engaging in what their proclivity and passion really is, then we're limiting their potential.
But if we don't have standardized testing, then what? What are the alternatives?
Well, under the current culture that we live in a very standardized testing culture. I wish that we didn't have this culture where we felt the need to fill these limited spots, because I admit there are limited spots, and I'm not trying to be unrealistic. But there are lots of ways we can fill limited spots by unstandardized methods. We can allow each children to show us they're ready for engaging in a particular limited resource in their own way and on their own terms, and that's what I'm arguing for.
My guest is Scott Barry Kaufman. His book, Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined, The Truth About Talent, Practice, Creativity, and the Many Paths to Greatness. In the past, we would talk about a Renaissance man. We don't talk about that anymore. Is it just that there's too much material to learn, or have the standards changed?
I think Renaissance people still exist. I think that what is a Renaissance person? So I think it's someone who has a lot of mental flexibility and is really open to engaging in lots of different things. I don't think you necessarily, if you want to be creative, it seems to be a trade-off here between expertise and creativity. So in terms of if you just want to be an expert, you really should spend a lot of years learning something. But if you want to be creative, there's a fine balance.
Well, we have cut back on many of the classes that encourage creativity.
That's
schools
for sure.
With tight budgets eliminate music departments, theater departments, art departments.
Can I just say that creativity can be infused in biology classes, physics classes, and we're still cutting back on we never had that.
Well, let's talk about your personal experience here. You write that as a child, you were placed in a special education school, diagnosed with an audio processing disorder and labeled as learning disabled. How did that happen?
Yeah, I repressed my childhood up until a couple weeks ago, and I'm talking
about it. Well,
you
wrote about it in this book.
And then I tell you, right, exactly. But I went through many years scientific studying this where I just repressed it because I thought I'd never have to think about it again. But, you know, I think that it is important to get this out there because the more people I tell the story to, I realize a lot of people went through this sort of situation. So, yeah, I was labeled with a learning disability when I was really young, central auditory processing disorder. It's actually very common. People on the autism spectrum, people had fluid in their ears. A lot of children have a lot of fluid in their ears. I had 21 ear infections by the age of 3. So I was essentially deaf for the first 3 years of my life, just couldn't process things. So it took me some time to catch up to the other kids in terms of processing auditory input in real time. But the way our system was structured back then, these labels were enduring.
But you obviously protested. Your parents must have protested. Your parents, I'm sure, thought
no.
They didn't.
I mean,
they
God just... bless my parents, but they didn't want things to be hard for me. So they listened to the experts. A lot of parents listen to the experts. And the experts aren't always right.
But you were able to understand complex concepts. You just weren't able to listen well.
That's right. And that's most people who are labeled with a learning disability have certain things they need targeted, skills they need to target, but it doesn't mean that it's the global intelligence.
So what happens when you're labeled as learning disabled and assigned to special education? Is that something that follows you the rest of your life?
It does. I can tell you, you know, what it looks like from the inside, and this is what spurred me to really want to study this stuff scientifically. From the inside, you get fed a steady stream diet of low expectations day after day. The rest of the kids look at you differently. The teachers look at you differently. They always made me sit in the front of the class. I would be in the back of the class being like, I'm ready to be, you know, really cool now. And the teacher would say, is Scotty Kaufman here today? He needs to sit in the front of the class. And it was embarrassing. It's humiliating.
But wasn't it good for you because you had hearing problems?
Which I compensated for. So the question is, maybe I never outgrew it. Maybe I still have it even right now in this conversation. But there's so many ways to compensate and overcompensate, learn strategic strategies to really be able to be functioning.
So you repeated third grade.
That's correct.
And eventually found yourself in a special education school?
School. In fact, everyone in my classroom was on Ritalin except for me, and I took sugar pills to class because I wanted to be cool like the rest of the kids in the class and made pretend I was taking Ritalin too.
And what was the curriculum like there?
You know, the curriculum wasn't dumbed down. I mean, it was okay, but there was a slower pace. In a way, it was kind of nice because we weren't singled out. We were all, you know, learning disabled. So,
well, did you think that some of those kids were truly learning disabled, or were they?
So this notion
were
of
any
truly,
mislabeled?
So this notion of mislabeling and truly, these are words as well that I want to challenge. So we talk about in the gifted community, they often talk about the truly gifted versus the not truly gifted, and I'm not convinced that I really know what that means. To be honest, to be truly learning disabled, I don't think that if you have we all have patterns of strengths and weaknesses, right? Even in the dyslexia realm, if you look at what they actually could apply to the spatial realm, they could be visually gifted if you wanted to label them that. You
know? And a lot of dyslexics go on to become artists.
Writers as well, writers.
But also a lot of artists were dyslexic. Chuck Close talks about what would have happened if he hadn't found art. He probably would have had a terrible life, but art saved him, even though he was dyslexic. But in other cases, don't some smart kids do poorly in school simply because they're bored?
I think that's very true. When now you say smart people, you're saying people that are very capable of accelerating academically?
A kid is sitting in a class and not doing well, the reason is he or she is not paying much attention.
So yes, but I think we can open up that concept to everyone. And I think that the research I've seen is that every single child, even those who are currently labeled gifted, they're failing too under the current system because these kids are not inspired. So I've shown that, and there's a lot of research showing that when we inspire kids, it's amazing how they can appear from looking dumb to looking, quote, gifted.
My guest is Scott Barry Kaufman, adjunct assistant professor of psychology at New York University and author of Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined, The Truth About Talent, Practice, Creativity, and the Many Paths to Greatness. It is published by Basic Books. We'll continue our conversation after this. We are back with Scott Barry Kaufman. His latest book, Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined, The Truth About Talent, Practice, Creativity, and the Many Paths to Greatness. It's published by Basic Books. You, after you were in that special school, you returned to public school, junior high, but you were still placed in what you call the slow track. How did you finally break out of that?
It wasn't until ninth grade. I knew something was wrong when I got back to middle school, and I was really interested in taking more challenging classes, but I didn't question. My self-esteem was pretty low by that point.
Well, are the kids treating you like you were a dummy?
I was bullied a lot. I was even bullied in the learning disabled school. I was bullied by the other learning disabled kids. I just couldn't get away from being bullied. I guess I was a target in every which way. But up until ninth grade, there was just one magical day where there was a teacher who was filling in for the regular teacher that day who took me aside and said, you know, I can tell that you're frustrated, you're bored. Why are you here?
Well, what about making friends? Usually we make friends with the kids who we are classmates with.
So I talk in a book about my friend Mark. He was my best friend, and we were in the special education together, and we ran a bulletin board system, if anyone remembers what a BBS is back in the 90s. And we had this whole alternate world that wasn't part of school where we were like kings of the BBS computer world.
So you had this teacher in the ninth grade who helped you move out of special education. Because she saw something in you?
Apparently.
And by the end of high school, you had worked your way into the gifted program.
Unofficially, I was an undercover gifted kid.
A couple of teachers took you under their wings?
Yeah, one particular teacher, Joyce Acton. She even though I didn't meet the formal IQ requirement, I went to the school psychologist and I said I'd like to be, in the gifted and challenged class. And he looked up my IQ chart from age 11. The one that decided to go to the learning disabled school, and he said, sorry, you're not gifted. And I went to this teacher, and out of the goodness of her heart, she let me in unofficially, and we kept it a secret from the other gifted kids that I wasn't really gifted.
Has your IQ varied over the years?
Well, here's the thing, and this is what I do want to inspire people.
Because you did wind up going to Carnegie Mellon, Yale, and then Cambridge.
Well, this is the thing, and I want to put this as succinctly as possible. Every step of the way, I haven't done well in standardized tests. My IQ will probably never significantly fluctuate the rest of my life, and I'm okay with that. Neither will my SAT scores or my GRE scores. Every step of the way, I've been denied because of those tests. So I was denied because of my SATs. I was denied because of my GREs, and I had to go through a back door, through an alternate route, to then show people that I could do it.
Did you find yourself having to play catch up in terms of workload?
Yes. So in terms of ninth grade, I was inspired. There was this moment where something clicked, and I said, you know what? I'm going to be intelligent. This is my new mission in life, is to be intelligent. And I did a huge catch up.
Well, then you have to get into college, and they do look at your school record.
They rejected me from the cognitive science program at Carnegie Mellon, which is what I wanted. Which what I am now, I'm a cognitive scientist. They rejected me because my SAT scores weren't high enough. And so what I did is I went in through opera. My grandfather was a cellist in the Philadelphia Orchestra. I had musical inclinations. I sang. So I went in through opera and then transferred into the program I wanted to later on.
Well, all in all, do you feel as though the system kind of failed you?
You know, if I look at this very zen, it didn't fail me. In some sort of cosmic way, it fueled me, right? And it fueled me. It made me want to learn more than maybe I would have been motivated to otherwise.
But I assume there are a lot of other kids who...
So many.
Who wind up saying, okay, you say I can't do this, you say I can't do that, my grades are bad. Well, I'll settle for something less than I am dreaming of.
That kills me. I mean, just hearing that breaks my heart, because there's so many conditions and things we could be doing in schools to make sure that doesn't happen.
And you write about the problems of these labels, gifted, challenged, disabled, and so on. Those words are so nebulous.
They are. And we live in a culture in which those labels are meaningful in that they allow people who have real needs get the resources they require.
On the other hand, wouldn't you want to put kids who have certain abilities together?
Let's put it this way. People with particular kinds of minds together, yes. But that's reframing the issue. You're saying different abilities. I'm saying these are just different kinds of minds.
Well, it has been learned that when teachers look at a person's record, they immediately have either higher or lower expectations of them.
That's absolutely correct. And also there are these self-fulfilling prophecies that you see the gap in ability widen significantly year after year after year. By the 10th year of this widening, you see huge differences when they didn't start off that way.
A lot of schools struggle to provide children with even the most basic of educations. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is part of the test and assess culture that we have built into our schools?
Absolutely. This is a culture. This is, I really do think we need to change the culture from the bottom up, which is what I'm arguing for, a fundamental shift in our level of analysis from an individual differences, comparing people to each other and standardized metrics, to a personal level.
Well, what happens in other countries? Many countries that do very well educationally.
Finland.
But many countries wind up with rote systems. Is that a better way of teaching people?
No, I think that's even a worse way. You know, look, I think that you could, there are countries that do worse than us. You know, I'm not saying America's like the worst in the world. I should say there's huge variability as well. I'm an advocate. I ran the book. I'm an advocate for like Montessori programs, but I'm an advocate for lots of other kinds of progressive programs. The thing is, why do we call those alternative education? That's what I'm saying. Doesn't make any sense to me. That should be what we should be doing.
So if we had public education adopt Montessori methods, that would be a good idea?
You know, not necessarily Montessori, but there's a key, because Montessori methods within themselves, there's lots of different variability in terms of how they implement it. But there's a clear set of conditions they outline in this book. There's rules of engagement that we can do if we design schools taking the latest psychological and developmental research into account on what actually motivates students, the importance of, I talk about hope, passion, some key skills that we're not even teaching, like critical thinking, self-regulation, things like that. We could be doing a lot better.
My guest is Scott Barry Kaufman. His latest book, Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined, The Truth About Talent, Practice, Creativity, and the Many Paths to Greatness. It is published by Basic Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. It seems to me that our culture often associates intelligence with speed and efficiency, that so many tests are really have time limits, and so you have to write this brilliant essay within a certain amount of time. You might be a slow writer, but a brilliant thinker.
So the global IQ score actually does a really good job of measuring that capacity. It's measuring something. I'm not saying that IQ doesn't measure anything. But then we wonder, why is it so strongly correlated with all these other things that are measured in the same way in a single slice of time in a timed situation? And then when you really think about it, it should be a no-brainer why all these things are so strongly correlated with each other.
So should tests not have time limits?
I mean, I think it depends on the purpose, what you're trying to measure for. Let's say you're trying to enter a particular profession where you have to think on your feet, and this sort of what's called fluid reasoning is very important. Then I do think that it's important to – I think it's important more generally to match the skills with what you're selecting for. But we're not even doing that. What we're doing is we're taking one skill, we're measuring everyone to that one metric.
Well, does the newer concept of intelligence mean that we should start guiding children towards specific studies at an earlier age, or exactly the opposite, that we should allow children the freedom to explore their interests and find their intelligence?
Well, you hit the nail on the head with the latter. You know, we should take kids' dreams seriously. This is something, it sounds very, I don't know if it sounds corny to say take kids' dreams seriously, but there's science showing that if you actually do that, people get closer to actually realizing those dreams.
But wouldn't that lead to some chaos in the classroom? One kid, it wants to draw all the time. The next kid loves to solve math problems.
No, I mean, there's experiments in progress right now of people doing this, and it's not leading to chaos. I work with this group here in New York called the Future Project, where they take everyone's kids seriously. They don't measure their IQ to limit that. And these kids are doing extraordinary projects that completely blow my mind.
Where would this begin? In the ed classes that teachers take?
You know, I think that it should start at the teacher training level. I think a lot of teachers aren't thought or taught about the latest developmental psychology research and the latest about the conditions that are conducive to flourishing. I think that would be wonderful if we started at that level.
Then you would wind up with classes that would probably have even more discipline problems than they do right now. Most teachers will tell you that when they start teaching, the biggest problem is keeping the kids quiet.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that there's still going to be huge variation in individual differences in how people respond in such a structured environment. But imagine a new world. Like, imagine a world in which there isn't these walls built around these students.
Well, you mentioned Finland. Finland has I can't think of too many brilliant people who have come out of Finland recently. And Nokia is not doing as well as Samsung or Apple.
But their academic achievement scores are good. Their standardized test scores they all go to college.
And to what end?
Okay, so that you raise a larger point. And, you know, what should be our—
I don't want to pick on Finland.
I know,
you know,
me neither.
Sure,
me neither. I love Finnish people.
Some of my best friends are Finns.
Yeah. I love Finnish people. But I think you raise a larger point, which is very important. We talk about what is the end. If the end is creative achievement, then we're going about everything completely wrong. You know, like we need to like do a complete topsy-turvy of our education system if we actually want to encourage people to creatively transform a field.
Well, I remember years ago there was a school called Summerhill, O'Neill Summerhill, and he was encouraging kids to find their special potential. Mm. And one day I wrote a college paper on Summerhill, and it turns out that nobody of real note graduated from Summerhill. So what did that mean ultimately? Does it really matter what kind of education you have if you've got that special thing?
No, I don't. And I also don't think it matters how fast you learn the material.
Well, your story really depended on some teachers who saw something special in you. So can teachers inspire kids even if the system can't?
I think what they saw is that I was frustrated and I was ready for more engagement in intellectual. And teachers should be on high alert at every moment that a student is ready for something. If I had my way, I would reconceptualize potential as merely readiness for engagement, nothing more, nothing less.
As a society, do we have too narrow a definition of genius, words like genius?
Oh, gosh, yes. Every day I see a new article of some child who's maybe 5 or 6 and can talk like they're 7 or 8, and then we say that child's a genius. What that does indicate is that child is intellectually different, may require needs in terms of acceleration and things of that nature. That child is not a genius. We have no idea if that child is going to be a genius, and we have no idea all the other kids who are slower if they will be geniuses.
Well, Einstein was slow, in school.
Yeah. And he wouldn't have made these headlines on Huffington Post. Every day I see a new headline saying genius 5-year-old can, you know, do something that most 5-year-olds can't. And yeah.
Well, we know that Mozart was quite brilliant at an early age. Was Beethoven?
I don't know much about Beethoven, but Mozart, if I may go to that example, that's a fascinating example because he was clearly a prodigy. But I've studied prodigies, and the thing you see with prodigies, they don't necessarily have high IQs. In fact, it seems to be unrelated to this IQ score. It's a very specific passion and proclivity to master a domain, and that's what I argue is how we should – that's what talent is at the end of the day. Talent is not something fully inborn. It's just a passion and proclivity to master particular rules of a domain, and it's partly in the genes, and it's part – and a heck of a lot of it can be influenced by environment.
If you had the opportunity to redo your entire education
– oh, boy.
Do you feel that the one that you had has made you a better, more educated person in the end?
I do. I actually do. And like I said, in some cosmic sort of way, I thank God. I thank, you know, everyone for contributing to this, allowing me to want to fight to prove. I feel like every step of the way I had to fight to show people that I was intellectually capable. And I'm tired of fighting. And thankfully now I don't have to take SATs anymore, any more standardized tests.
Well, you do have to get the approval of your students as a teacher, don't you?
That's true. And you can ask my students if I'm doing that, but I think I'm doing an okay job there.
And this is your second book?
No, this is my first single-authored book.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I've done academic volumes, and I've co-authored books, but yeah.
And where do you think that your work is going to lead you? Do you think that...
I'm open to the journey. I really don't
but
know.
Do you think that we'll ever really understand the nature of intelligence?
I don't think that should be our aim. I think it should be our aim to understand the unique brand of intelligence that every human being on this planet can offer.
Scott Barry Kaufman, his book, Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined, The Truth About Talent, Practice, Creativity, and the Many Paths to Greatness. It is published by Basic Books, and I want to thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much.